There was a great deal of discussion, of course, about the length of training for residential staff, and 14 months seemed to be about the only about the limit of length that one could expect to be paid for, because, mind you, the all these staff were receiving grants at the time for training, so really the budget was a very considerable one. The other main development, which took a great deal of time of the training inspectors, was the running of short refresher courses. And we had these on almost continuously. I was trying to remember the number we did in a year, but I know we very seldom had a gap of more than a week between the courses. And we were planning these sort of 6 months ahead, and the finding of suitable residential accommodation, the getting out of a program which would enable the voluntary organization, the local authorities, to choose which course was suitable for their staff, and then selecting from amongst these and getting the whole program going was a tremendously absorbing job. As the full-time courses got more established, so one was able more and more to leave those to the local authorities and the tutors and the universities to run on their own. Looking back, I wonder whether we spent almost too much time on this, but on the other hand, it seemed to us to be crucial to the acceptance of the newly trained staff that the rest of the staff should at least be given the opportunity of hearing what it was all about and getting what they could out of short courses. And I think they were important. As time went on, we had special ones for groups like approved school staff and even children's officers themselves. I remember being very apprehensive about having a short course for children's officers, but we did manage to pull that one off. And then we also had courses. In fact, the very last one I ran when I left the Home Office was for members of local authority committees.
Yes.
Not a very successful course, I may say. At these courses, there would naturally be a lot of discussion about the criteria for foster home or residential placement. And I suppose taking up the theme of the Curtis Committee, we did feel, certainly in the early years, that there were very great advantages in foster home placement if only the right choice could be made. One thing looking back, which I feel impressed with, is the fact that we not only in the Curtis Committee stressed the advantages, indeed the superior advantages, of foster home placement, but we also laid great stress on the family-sized residential group. Now, I think this arose from the fact that we didn't give anything like enough attention to the welfare of residential staff. That may seem a funny thing to say at this point. We were, I think, aware that you would have to have a home of a certain size in order to justify at least two people looking after a group of children. But I think it was just as important, really, for us to spend as much time on the kind of life that residential staff could lead as it was to spend time on the kind of life that the children could lead.
Yes.
Because obviously the most important thing was the children's relationship with the staff.
Yes.
And increasingly, I think, as I got either direct or indirect experience of what was happening in the small homes, I felt that we had been much too optimistic about the rather isolated small home with just two people running a small group of children of mixed ages.
Mm-hmm.
Because if something went wrong, it went very seriously wrong, and there was no sort of balance of personalities to ventilate things and get a readjustment made. So that if you were to ask, well, what were the mistakes of the Curtis Committee? I think that would be one of them, that if I were to have a new Curtis Committee now, I would say, well, the first thing, almost the first thing, is to find out what kind of people are likely to go in for residential work, and to deploy them in such a way that their relationships with the children will be as beneficial as possible. Now, that means something that I've always come up against, and that I suppose everybody in social work comes up against this, and that is the variety of persons in social work. There are some people who will flourish. For example, if one considers schools, I'm quite sure that comprehensive schools can be run very successfully, large comprehensive schools, by certain kinds of people.
Yes.
But if other kinds of people get into it, they are chaos.
Yes.
Other kinds of schools can be run very successfully by people who could never begin to run a comprehensive school. But how do we know about the provision of these different kinds of people?
Yes.
And so I would be very much against, in fact, I think this would be influential in making me not vote as I used to for the Labour Party, going all comprehensive, because I think it doesn't make sense in terms of staff.
Yes.
And in the same way, as I say, if one were to think again of Curtis, I would think of a great variety of establishments rather than let's have mostly this kind or let's have mostly that kind. I think that's the end of it. Looking back on a life's professional experience of social work, I think what impresses me is the kind of dilemma that there is always between concentration on the very subtle, difficult business of understanding individual variation and individual ways of meeting the needs of individuals with the very obvious knowledge that social conditions are constantly creating the kind of difficulties with which we are dealing. But at the same time, with the fact that some individuals will always emerge as problems in spite of what one would regard as very favorable social conditions. And this is a continuing dilemma which is reflected all the way through the development of social services and the development of training. And I think it will always be so. If one is thinking about the people who enter social services, I think that broadly speaking, one might say that some people temperamentally are much better fitted to deal with the individual problems, and other people, by and large, more fitted to deal with the broad administrative problems. And if this sort of division of people entering by different sort of doors into the social service, I suppose that continually there may tend to be more and more separation between them. And that one of the problems is bringing these together. Now, there are some people who can combine these two different approaches, but these people, I think, are rare. And I would think probably the same is true in the teaching profession, if one must consider the idea of very large schools. There would be some people who can manage this and who would not be very good with individual children or individual staff, and other people who can't. But then the rare individual, whom one can probably pick out in each generation, who is extremely good at both, and then they stand out. I don't know whether Lywood was any good at organization, but I imagine he was, too, in order to have attracted and run a successful school and demonstrated new ideas. As far as the specialization in social work, with which I've been mainly concerned, first in the mental health course and then in the child care services, I suppose time will show the extent to which this sort of specialization is necessary. I'm not sufficiently in touch with things now to know how much is being added to the departure for generic training. Again, I think that it's likely that some individuals are more suitable for some branches of work than others. I hear stories and have very slight experience of people who now do become employed in the social services departments who know extremely little about psychiatric problems. Most people know more about children because of their everyday living than they do about, say, psychotic illnesses. But of course this has been and will continue to be, I suppose, one of the issues. Looking back, again, I should think there would be some agreement that even if the specialized courses were not desirable as a permanent feature of training for social work, at the time at which they were established, they demonstrated something which could not have been so demonstrated unless there'd been a period of specialization. Certainly I think this was true in the child care services. Well, I think also it really was true in the psychiatric services. But then there weren't any practically, you see. There were child care workers, but there really were not social workers in the mental health services before, practically speaking. So that the situations were different. But even so, whether this is a sort of self-justification or not, I don't know. You see, Eileen Younghusband said in print somewhere, if only at the time of the Curtis Committee it had been decided that this was something for general training.
Yes.
Or was it the Curtis Committee? I'm not sure. It wasn't the Mental Health Committee she said that about. Then all the development would have been more satisfactory. I don't believe that is so. I think that you needed this period of demonstration and accumulation of experience and knowledge which could then be more generally used. And I think that the fact, as you yourself said, that psychiatric social workers went into all fields of social work and research and publication and everything else, meant that although they concentrated on one area of thinking for a time, they did so in such a way that it could be used in a great many different contexts.
Yes.
I don't think that anyone can look back and say what was the most successful thing they did in life. You, looking back, realize the things that you would like to have done differently, and the ones in which you failed, and the ones that you did perhaps a little better than others. But to talk of least good and best, I think, is always a fallacy. I can, I think, however, say that certain years of one's professional work were more enjoyable than others. And I wouldn't have much doubt in saying that my most enjoyable years were the ones at the London School of Economics. I find that I'm still very attached to the School of Economics, and I'm very proud that I've recently been made an honorary fellow of the school, and that this will mean that I shall visit it more often than I might otherwise have done. What was it about the School of Economics that delighted me? Well, I suppose, for one thing, it was the first really responsible job that I had at an age when one felt more or less capable of doing a responsible job. I think I enjoyed probably the fact that I was almost the only person doing that particular kind of job at that particular time, and so one had a sort of pioneer feeling about it. It also provided, in an awfully interesting way, for very close contact with outside people, with outside universities, which I very much enjoyed, with friends in the social services with whom I'd been involved, and with individuals of great interest who served on the consultative committee, and this in a setting of individual members of the School of Economics academic staff who were themselves quite outstanding. When I first went there, Sir William Beveridge was director, and Graham Wallace was still there. Lasky was there throughout my time. Malinowski had the next door room. Hugh Dalton was on the other side. And I found all this intellectual stimulus and widening of one's experience very exciting. I felt at that stage in my life very much a junior member, and I was awfully shy when I first went there, I remember. And I suppose that for a long time I didn't feel I sort of wholly mingled with the rest of the staff, but by degrees one did. And to have anthropology on one side and the future Chancellor of the Exchequer on the other side of one's room was something that one couldn't expect to happen in one's life, really. And I made very, very close and good friends at the School of Economics. One of the impressive people was, I think, Lord Chorley, who was influential in some of the children's legislation, and who was also influential in the independence of India. I remember his coming back when he'd been on the Indian expedition to report on the prospect of Indian independence. All that kind of thing you were exposed to.
Yes.
I think one of the nicest things that happened was when I had a letter from Lord Chorley saying that he had mentioned my name in the House of Lords as connected with progressive legislation for children. Quite undeserved. But one of the distinguished things that happened to me at the London School of Economics was being telephoned after the end of the summer term by Sir William Beveridge's secretary to ask would I give him a game at deck tennis, at which he soundly beat me. That's the end of my